Hello everyone, Marco Werman here. It has not been an easy 2020 for any of us. Somehow we at The World have managed to keep cranking out a news show about how the entire planet has been challenged by and coping with this historic disease. But behind every broadcast and all the reporting and production that go into it, there's an awareness that you are also trying to do your best to keep your chins up and of those next to you through this adversity. As I record this, we need 450 more people to donate to meet our goal of 1,000 donors by the end of this year. When you make a gift of $100 or more, you will not only receive an exclusive invite to a virtual party with me and the team, I will also personally thank you on a podcast episode. Donate today to The World to support our coverage tomorrow. Right now, go to theworld.org/give. And from everybody here at The World, thank you. Germany is getting ready for a mass vaccination campaign by building huge centers where they'll carry it out.
We can vaccinate 3,000 to 4,000 people a day in this hall alone.
Now they're just waiting for the vials to arrive. Also on the show today, in Nigeria, another large kidnapping, this time hundreds of boys taken from a school. For some, a harrowing escape.
One of the boys said he crawled for several miles through the forest before he got back home.
And the election may be over, it's still tough to talk politics with loved ones.
Especially my grandpa. He kept saying, Trump won, Trump won, but like in Spanish. And I was just like, no, he did it. It's not done yet. Stop listening to your news.
I'm Marco Werman. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Good to be with you. The vials have shipped and people are rolling up their sleeves. This week, the U.S. and Canada launched their coronavirus vaccine programs. The primary vaccine comes from a U.S.-German partnership between New York-based Pfizer and the German company BioNTech. But there are also lots of other vaccine efforts in the works worldwide. The World's Ilana Gordon has been tracking the success and setbacks of these projects. Ilana, give us the overall vaccine picture. What all is out there?
Well, again, Marco, as you mentioned, there is one vaccine that's been licensed or given emergency authorization in Western countries, in the U.S., the U.K., Canada, and then non-Western countries, I should add, like Singapore, and that is the BioNTech-Pfizer one. But, you know, Moderna's vaccine, the one in your backyard in Cambridge, uses a similar vaccine approach, and that could be approved as early as this week in the United States. But at the same time, there's actually about a dozen other vaccines that are in what's called phase 3 clinical trials. And on top of that, there's something like 50 other vaccine trials that are recruiting participants.
I mean, it is pretty remarkable when you think about how we're almost at a year into this pandemic of a new virus, and we've got not one, but multiple vaccines potentially being viable.
I know. It almost just warrants like a moment of pause by just how incredible that is. I mean, when this pandemic started, it was this all hands on deck for scientists and for manufacturers. And so the whole process is pretty much scrunched from something that usually takes years while still maintaining that rigorous process. And, you know, as much as the news has been about Pfizer finally breaking through that milestone of actually being deployed for public use, it's important to point out that science, it is a process. You know, you try something within a framework to study it, as all these vaccines are now trying to do. You learn, you adjust, you repeat to prove what works. And on that note, Marco, I wanted to also add that this month marked the announcement of the first vaccine trial to fail.
Which one was that?
So that was from the University of Queensland in Australia. And it wasn't a problem with the vaccine itself, but they found that people who took it were falsely testing positive for HIV.
Well, as you said, science is a process, trial and error and trial again. Back to the vaccines that are further along. Now that the Pfizer one is out, what does that mean for others that are still being developed? Are they less relevant?
So this is something that I've been wondering a lot about. And what I've learned is that no one vaccine can do it all. I spoke with Polly Roy about this. She's a virologist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And she says that different vaccines may work better for different populations and scenarios.
None of these, a single virus vaccine going to be probably meet all the requirements. For instance, maybe they will protect short time, may not be long lasted. Maybe they are not suitable for children very young. You don't know that.
I mean, Roy stresses that this Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, the data is really strong. But again, we still don't know some things, like how long immunity will even last from it.
Ilana, what other vaccines are further along?
So there's the mRNA vaccines, a type of technology and approach, and that's the Pfizer and Moderna ones. Novavax is a U.S. company that has a protein-based vaccine that's coming along. And I wanted to just kind of differentiate because these vaccines do have different approaches, although they all seem, most of them, to be going after that spike protein and the virus to train our bodies to address that. And then there are vaccines that use a genetically modified, inactive virus that's not harmful in humans, like from a common cold. Johnson & Johnson does this. The Oxford AstraZeneca one in the UK also does, as are some of the vaccines from China and Russia, which are already deploying their vaccines too. We've been talking a lot about the ones in Western countries. In some cases, though, they've been deployed before clearing that final clinical trial phase. But here's where things, Marco, got kind of interesting recently. The UK-based Oxford AstraZeneca actually announced that they're going to collaborate with Russia's Sputnik researchers to see if they can combine their vaccines and how that might work.
So lots of vaccines deployed and in development all over the globe. One thing that's clear already, Ilana, something we've reported on the show, is really wealthy nations will soon have enough vaccine to cover entire populations. But what about lower income nations?
This is a big challenge and problem. Nico Luciani is someone I talked to from Oxfam. It's a global NGO that's been tracking the supplies of the vaccine, which countries have what deals are happening. And he says that rich countries have jumped to the front of the line and they've secured deals at the expense of everyone else.
It's quite troublesome. You know, we're starting to talk and think and hope a lot for a vaccine spring, but right now a huge part of the world won't be seeing any vaccines next year at all.
For infectious disease specialist Marco, that does not bode well for the pandemic because there is this really common phrase that's often referred to when it comes to pandemics and diseases that spread, which is no one's safe until everyone's safe.
The World's Ilana Gordon, thank you very much for explaining this.
You're welcome, Marco.
We've seen a lot of innovation and creativity during the pandemic. Fashion labels have switched from producing ball gowns to face masks. Hotels have become isolation centers. And public spaces like parts of New York Central Park have been converted into pop-up ICUs. It's hoped that these changes will slip into the past as vaccines start to roll out around the world and people get them. But innovation continues. In Germany, they're in overdrive to build hundreds of massive vaccination centers. The World's Bianca Hillier has more.
COVID-19 cases in Germany are rising.
Dass die Maßnahmen, die wir am 2. November begonnen hatten,
Chancellor Angela Merkel announced that starting tomorrow, Germans will enter a strict lockdown. But while many of the country's doors are closing, these mass vaccination centers are just opening up. Construction has been underway on about 400 centers across Germany, and the federal government there gave the country's 16 states until today, Tuesday, to finish setup. According to Health Minister Jens Spahn, they're ready. Spahn says these centers are equipped with everything needed to help stop the spread, adding that this approach is necessary because of the vaccine's special transport and storage requirements. It needs to stay really cold. Other governments are setting up these spaces too, including in England, Italy, and several U.S. states, but not yet to the same scale as in Germany. Local officials in Hessen, Germany, told me that their 28 centers will be finished on time, ready to vaccinate 30,000 people every day. Six more centers have popped up across the capital city, including the Arena Berlin, a massive exhibition space. Project manager Albrecht Bromer is in charge.
In 4 Wochen ist hier voller Betrieb.
We can vaccinate 3,000 to 4,000 people a day in this hall alone. The six centers in the capital will be able to receive a total of 20,000 patients a day.
Bromer told local media that more than 3,000 people were hired to help build out Berlin's structures. The design started with Lego bricks and little figurines, he added, but they rose quickly in sophistication. Upon completion, the centers look similar to voting locations, with private booths set up in rows. Every detail was considered. Brohmer said the flow inside the centers is crucial.
Die müssen sozusagen im Fluss laufen.
There must be no lines. No one should bring the coronavirus home when they come to protect themselves against it.
Thousands of medical staff have been called on to help. Everything seems to be in place, except the vaccine itself. That's right. Germany doesn't have an approved vaccine yet. They're waiting for the EU to make the call for all 27 member states. Health Minister Jens Spahn says these 400 vaccination centers are on standby.
Haben wir eben uns überlegt, es ist besser, Impfzentren einsatzbereit zu
haben. It's better to have vaccination centers ready with delays in the vaccine than the other way around, which would be having the vaccine and no vaccination centers ready to go.
Authorities expect these centralized centers will be the bedrock of an efficient and effective vaccination campaign once there is an approved vaccine. In a statement today, Spahn said he hopes that approval will come before Christmas and that the country's vaccination centers can be put to use by the end of the year. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
It's a member of NATO, but Turkey went ahead a few years back and bought a Russian-made weapon system. Washington, not surprisingly, is now slapping targeted sanctions on Turkey for that move. The sanctions have been threatened ever since Turkey made the purchase of the weapons. Nor is it a surprise that the Turkish government is condemning the sanctions, calling them a grave mistake. Turkey also said it would retaliate in a matter and timing it deems appropriate. Joining me now is İlhan Tanir, a Turkish political analyst and the executive editor of Awal News. İlhan, thanks for being with us. What is the significance of these sanctions on Turkey, and how do they affect Turkey economically?
Well, it's significant because this doesn't happen very often to NATO allies. Turkey has been a NATO ally for 70 years, and at one time, just a few years ago, was called as strategic partner of Washington. Now we see that Washington imposed sanctions on Turkey due to its close relations with Russian arm exporters. So for the relationship between the countries and for the alliance of NATO, this has been a pretty significant step.
These are targeted sanctions. So who exactly is being sanctioned here, and what will that mean for them?
İsmail Demir is one of the Turkish officials, the most important one, who is sanctioned, but he's boss is Turkish president, and Turkish President Erdogan has been making it very clear that this is his decision to buy Russian defense system. So the question is, why would you go after Mr. Demir while we know who made the decision? Obviously, Washington did not want to target specifically and personally Mr. Erdogan, and he's still trying to find a way to mend the ties at some point by putting pressure on Ankara to send back this Russian S-400 defense system.
Mm. So, İlhan, when Turkey says it'll retaliate for these U.S. sanctions, what would that look like? Counter-sanctions or something harsher?
So Turkey really does not have a lot of leverage on U.S., but Turkey also resides in one of the most important and valuable real estate of the world. U.S. needs Turkey for many reasons, whether dealing with Russia or Iran or Syria, Iraq, Eastern Mediterranean, Greece, part of NATO, with the EU relations. Turkey can make things, you know, more difficult for U.S. in these areas I just mentioned, just making things more difficult and, you know, not partnering on these issues with Washington would be a leverage on Erdogan's side.
There's obviously the contradiction, İlhan, of a NATO member working with Russia on military hardware. But what is really the main problem the U.S. has with these S-400 Russian weapon systems? What do you think?
As recent as yesterday, Turkish top officials have been still saying the same thing. S-400s will be stand-alone systems. We will protect this. We will not let F-35 secrets to be viewed by S-400's radar system. But whatever the Turkish officials have been saying just did not make really a difference. I think real reason is that the trust between Washington and Ankara have been tremendously damaged.
İlhan Tanir is a Turkish political analyst and the executive editor of Awal News. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. All year we've been hearing from first-time Latino voters. It's part of our series Every 30 Seconds. And as I point out each week, we call it that because just about every 30 seconds a Latino reaches voting age in this country. Today we return to San Diego, where 18-year-old Marlene Herrera voted for Joe Biden, even though he was not her first choice. Today, Herrera reflects on the political divides that persist within her own family. From station KPBS, Max Rivlin-Nadler has his final update.
Marlene saw her Mexican-American family go both ways during the election.
My dad's house, they have a very different political view than me, and I spent that election week here. So while everyone was rooting for the other side, I wasn't, especially my grandpa. He kept coming out while the counting was still coming in, like saying Trump won, Trump run, but like in Spanish. And I was just like, no, he did it. It's not done yet. Stop listening to your news.
Her father and mother split up when she was young. So she divides her time between households. Her father's parents are immigrants from Mexico. They live with him and they all supported Donald Trump. Marlene's mother was polling for Joe Biden. In the days after the election, she kept in touch with her mom about the results.
But my mom and I, we were messaging each other, like, have you seen the election? Did you see? And then the minute that Philadelphia turned, it cleared the way for Biden. My mom was the first one to call me. Did you see the election results? Did you see them? I'm like, yes, I did. I just woke up, by the way. Thank you.
A third of Latinos usually vote Republican. But Trump was able to build on that in this year's election, which left a lot of people wondering why. Marlene, who felt the impact of anti-immigrant rhetoric in her own high school, was coming to terms with her grandparents' support of Trump.
I think my main thing that surprised me was my grandparents, considering the fact that they did come here as immigrants, and the whole hate that was sparked around the community because of Trump. It's kind of hard for me to understand how they could vote. Everything you've gone through to stay in this country, to have your green card and stuff. How can you do that? But I've mentioned before, it comes down to perspective.
Reflecting on these choices, Marlene realizes there's so much more that impacts someone's politics than just their identity. Her own father, who manages a grocery store, saw his hard work translate to economic stability. Marlene says this has led to a more comfortable life for her brother, Junior, who lives full-time with their father.
As much as my dad helps me out, he gets me the things that I need. I didn't grow up the same way Junior did. I grew up in a single mother household, having to ride the bus every day, my mom being on food stamps, getting government help.
Marlene's own experience has influenced her politics. But changing the minds of people in her immediate family, once they're made up, has been challenging, especially during a year where they've all been stuck inside together.
It's so hard to change a perspective. I know I get frustrated. That's just a big split between both my sides of my family.
For The World, I'm Max Rivlin-Nadler in San Diego.
Max Rivlin-Nadler joins me now from San Diego. Hey, Max.
Hey, Marco.
We just heard that from Marlene Herrera. I think a lot of families can relate to her situation. Some families can bring up politics at dinner time. Others cannot. You were in touch with Marlene all year. Up until this update, your conversations with her focused a lot on higher education and a lack of diversity in schools. Why were those so important to her?
Marlene is a really studious student. She really cares about getting where she wants to go through her studies. In fact, she told me that she had made a decision a really long time ago that the way out of City Heights, which was the neighborhood that she grew up in, was through her studies. And when the time came to decide whether to be close to home or go elsewhere in the state for school, she chose San Francisco State. And that was because she wanted to pursue her studies and have that be her path to a better life for her and her family. On top of that, basically, she really felt that her high school experience was pretty rough in terms of a lack of diversity. She didn't see a lot of people that looked like her in her school because she was bused to a school in a different district that had a lot of people from different backgrounds than her. And especially during the Trump administration, she felt as if she couldn't be herself as a Latina in Trump's America.
As I listened to Marlene's news post-election, it sounded like she's slowly accepting the different political viewpoints that are in her family. What impact do you think this could have on her as her own political worldview evolves?
Yeah, so her political worldview was very much shaped by her own upbringing and the fact that she was splitting her time between kind of two very different experiences. There was her life with her mom and her sister. Her mom was a single mother working several jobs, going to high school herself at the same time that Marlene was, and then going over to her father's house because she was splitting time, and her father, who was a grocery store manager, had a comfortable life, was working extremely hard. She wanted to make that very clear, and she was thankful for everything her father did, but she got to see kind of the quote-unquote American dream really work for her father. So that shaped her politically, was that basically your outlook can have a difference based on your experiences in life, and she's not going to hold that against people.
Has Marlene's grandfather accepted the election results now? He originally said Trump won.
I'm unsure about that. I know that basically there was this divide that Marlene didn't really want to wade into because she was kind of really into keeping the peace. Basically, her father had asked her, how are you going to vote? Who are you supporting? And she didn't even tell her dad. She just said, I'm staying out of it. You know I have a different political opinion. And her stepmom told her, oh, you made a right decision there because basically if you want to keep the peace, it's up to you to keep your political opinion to yourself in these situations.
Also, Marlene grew up in a border town. What did you learn, Max, about the Latino youth vote on the California-Mexico border through Marlene?
This was an electorate that went hard for Bernie Sanders during the 2020 primary, and then afterwards was a little bit in the political wilderness. And I think that showed up in turnout, which was up because these people were activated, but not everyone was voting for Joe Biden. A lot of people felt disenchanted with the entire political system. Some people voted for Trump. Overwhelmingly young people, especially in border areas like San Diego, which has a long history of political activism dating back to Prop 187 in the 90s, people were voting heavily Democratic, especially young people. And that was a lot in reaction to increased border enforcement and the antagonism of the Trump administration.
So what surprised you while covering the Latino electorate in California this year?
I think I was surprised just by basically how engaged a lot of people were, a lot of young people just talking with high schoolers. People knew what was going on. They were following it through social media. People knew who the players were. They were drawn to some unconventional candidates. Andrew Yang especially was a lot of people's first answer. I think people liked his appeal to young people and also that he was offering a concrete policy example with the universal basic income. And I think mostly what I was excited or what interested me was that people didn't view this as a one-time thing, that they're going to vote and move on, that this is going to be a longer political project on their part to secure safety in the United States.
Reporter Max Rivlin-Nadler in San Diego, he's part of our Every 30 Seconds series. Max, thank you very much for this update on Marlene.
Thanks, Marco.
For more on our year-long series, Every 30 Seconds, including a short film exploring the lives of eight young Latinos and their experiences voting for the first time, just head to theworld.org/every30seconds. Just a quick reminder from me, Marco Werman, and the World team. Over the past year, The World has brought you reporting on the most pressing issues of 2020 from all corners of the globe. The World is not going anywhere. We are determined more than ever to push through to keep bringing you the expansive global coverage you rely on, no matter what. We've been right there with you all year long. Now we're calling on you to be there for us. We're just 450 people away from reaching our goal of 1,000 donors. When you make a gift of $100, or if you possibly can, $1,000, you'll get to hear your name in our podcast credits. You'll also get an invite to a virtual party with all the incredible people who make this show possible. Help us keep The World accessible to everybody across the globe. Donate today before the year ends. Go to theworld.org/give. And from everybody here at The World, thank you. In the final weeks of the Trump administration, an increase in the use of the federal death penalty.
That is at odds not only with global trends, but also with changing political perspectives and public opinion in the United States.
Things could shift dramatically on capital punishment come the 20th of January. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Some Republicans still don't accept the result, but apparently the Electoral College vote was good enough for Moscow. Today, Russian President Vladimir Putin congratulated Joe Biden on winning the U.S. election, one of the last world leaders to do so. In a statement, Putin said he wished the president-elect every success and that he was ready for interaction. But U.S.-Russian relations are currently at a low point, so how will Biden interact with Russia? Reporter Charles Maines joins us now from Moscow. First of all, Charles, why did Russia or Putin wait so long to acknowledge Biden's victory in the election?
Well, the Kremlin's argument here is that they didn't want to get sucked into DC politics again as they did in 2016. Now, let's not forget that Russia still to this day insists it did not interfere in the elections, the U.S. presidential elections in 2016. So this time around, they said, let's let the internal fight play out in D.C. Let's not offend Trump should he prevail in his bid through the courts to overturn the results and congratulate Biden when the results are finalized, which is what happened after the Electoral College vote finally came through. But let's not forget, as you note, you know, Putin was one of the last holdouts of major leaders. And behind the scenes, this is mainly seen as a sign that there's a chilly attitude towards Biden and a bit of disappointment that Donald Trump wasn't reelected.
So when Joe Biden enters the Oval Office next month, what will be some of the priorities for his administration when it comes to the U.S. relationship with Russia?
Well, the good news for Russia that one of Biden's priorities will be arms control. He'll be working quickly to extend the New START treaty negotiated by Biden's old boss, Barack Obama. That treaty ends February 5th, so he doesn't have a lot of time. But this is something that Vladimir Putin wants too. In fact, he wanted to do it with Donald Trump, but they were unable to get it done for many reasons, including Trump's insistence that China be part of the New Deal. Now, the bad news for Russia, Biden seems to want to reinforce the transatlantic relationship. That means NATO, strengthening NATO, and that's likely to hem Russia in. You know, also, Biden has made clear he's interested in promoting democracy, U.S. values, as he likes to say. And that probably means a bigger interest in human rights. That includes not only to Russia, but to its surrounding former Soviet republics. That's Ukraine, Belarus, and others.
Of course, context matters a lot here. Right now, U.S.-Russia relations are at a very low point. Multiple reasons for that, but just remind us, Charles, of some of the big sticking points.
Well, you know, reasons go back to the end of the Soviet Union and Russia's disappointments with what followed, of course. Frankly, resentments that Vladimir Putin has mined and exploited effectively over the last 20 years as he's tried to rebuild Russia into this global power again. But there are, of course, these more recent reasons that the two have had a falling out. Russia's actions to interfere in the 2016 elections, the annexation of Crimea in 2014, even this recent hack against multiple U.S. agencies, that includes the State Department, Homeland Security, the NSA. All this suggests that sanctions and penalties issued by the U.S. against Russia have done not too much to deter those efforts. And then, of course, most recently, we have this poisoning of Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader here. And this new blockbuster investigation that came out earlier this week that alleges direct involvement by the FSB in the attempt on Navalny's life.
The FSB, the Russian FBI, essentially. What do you know about the personal relationship between Putin and Joe Biden? Have they met before? And what have they said about each other?
Well, they have. You know, Biden certainly is a longtime hand in the Senate in terms of foreign policy in the U.S., and he's been to Russia many times, even the Soviet Union. But Biden was also the originator of the so-called reset with Russia. This was during the Obama years. This idea that the two sides, Washington and Moscow, could work together to address mutual issues of concern. It didn't work out, famously. And certainly we've seen moments where Biden was quite adversarial with Putin. In 2011, there's a sort of famous incident where he says he looked into Putin's eyes and told him he didn't have a soul, which is, of course, the opposite of what George W. Bush told Putin when they met during his presidency. Putin famously laughed and said, well, we understand one another.
It makes me wonder, Charles, whether anyone in the White House could repair this historically chilly relationship as long as Putin is the Russian president. I mean, what would it take?
Well, that's right. You know, if you think about it, Putin's been around for 20 years and he's gone through every president coming in saying that they can repair Russian relations. Sometimes it's called the reset. Sometimes it's called just getting along with Moscow, as Donald Trump liked to say. You know, he's certainly witnessed this rolling through several presidencies with not a lot of effect. Certainly, Putin has a very skeptical attitude towards the U.S.-Russian relationship after all these years.
From the Kremlin's perspective, how much of a priority is it for Russia to improve relations with the U.S.? Or does Russia have more urgent issues to deal with domestically?
It's interesting. I'd argue that while the U.S.-Russian relationship is important, it's almost even a fixation for the Kremlin. But improving those relations isn't necessarily always the goal. Polls show here, in fact, that most Russians don't expect Biden presidency to lead to better relations, so there's no expectation from the public. You know, and in many ways, feeding this adversarial relationship with the U.S. is in Putin's interest, so long as it projects this idea of Russia on par with the U.S. or even, you know, superior to the U.S. And so in that sense, you know, Russia's strength, real or imagined, and sticking it to the U.S. where it can, distracts from problems that they have at home, including the economy, the Kremlin's response to the COVID crisis, or this poisoning of the opposition leader, Alexei Navalny.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow, good to have you with us today. Thank you.
You bet.
Last week, the Trump administration carried out the execution of two prisoners on death row, Brandon Bernard and Alfred Bourgeois. Three more people are set to be put to death before Trump leaves office. This is significant. It marks the first time in more than a century that federal executions have been carried out during a president's lame duck period. It's also a reminder that the U.S. is increasingly out of step with much of the rest of the world when it comes to the death penalty. Delphine Lorteau is the executive director of the Cornell Center on the Death Penalty Worldwide. Delphine, put the U.S. in context for us. Where does the U.S. sit compared with other similar nations when it comes to the death penalty?
The United States is really bucking a global trend that we've seen start to develop after the Second World War and really accelerate in the past 20 to 25 years. And this trend is one towards abolition of the death penalty, but also in states that continue to use the death penalty, towards an ever more restricted use of capital punishment.
Why is it a concern that these executions are happening on the watch and on the orders of a lame duck president and White House?
We already know President-elect Biden has announced that he would halt federal executions after inauguration. We've seen a shift in his position vis-a-vis capital punishment over the years. Last year, he tweeted that a system in which there was no possible redress for people who are executed after wrongful convictions had to change. The executions of the last few months of the Trump presidency reflect an attachment to the institution of capital punishment that is at odds not only with global trends, but also with changing political perspectives and public opinion in the United States.
So the UN recently wrapped up its Universal Periodic Review of the U.S., which is when they evaluate a country's human rights record. One of their recommendations was to eliminate the death penalty. How do America's allies see the use of the death penalty here? Does it compromise, like, our leadership on other human rights issues globally?
My organization tracks executions carried out around the world, and so far in 2020, there are only six other states that have carried out more executions than the United States. They are China, Iran, Egypt, Iraq, Somalia, and North Korea. If you look at this list of countries, and if you look at the fact that within, for instance, member states of the G20, the U.S., is one of five states that carries out executions, but only Saudi Arabia has carried out more executions than the U.S. in that group. If you look regionally within the Americas, this is the 12th consecutive year that the United States is the sole country that has carried out executions. There's no doubt that the U.S. is an outlier when it comes to its use of capital punishment, and there is also no doubt that this affects its credibility when it comes to bringing human rights challenges or raising concerns about human rights violations in other countries.
You talk about China, Iran, Saudi Arabia. I mean, these are places American leaders typically criticize when it comes to human rights, and yet we're right there with them in these executions. How are we supposed to come to terms with this paradox?
The position of the United States and the position of many other countries that do continue to carry out executions is that the death penalty is not a question of human rights. It is a question of the administration of criminal justice, and as such, an issue that is best left to individual sovereign states. The problem with this argument is that it ignores that when you're talking about human rights, you're not just talking about the death penalty in and of itself. You're also talking about the process and the procedures surrounding the death penalty. You're talking about the criminal legal system as a whole. It's much more difficult for countries that continue to apply the death penalty to defend fair trial practices that under international human rights law are supposed to be provide fair trial guarantees above and beyond what is already required in other criminal cases and stand beside their application of capital punishment.
And what about in other countries where the death penalty is still used? Are movements to abolish it gaining ground this year in other parts of the world?
So this year has been interesting. Because of the pandemic, the number of executions carried out around the world has plummeted. And really, that's one of the reasons why these federal executions are really outliers in this global trend. Many countries have deemed it not safe to carry out executions. So in Saudi Arabia, for instance, we've been able to confirm 13 executions as opposed to 184 last year. In the countries that I listed earlier, it's hard to say that there has been a move towards abolition per se, but abolition per se is the, you know, it's not the only goal. We have seen in Iran, for instance, a dramatic decrease in the number of executions and death sentences since a major drug law reform in 2017. In China as well, there have been many credible reports that over the past decade, the number of executions, while still very high, may have decreased substantially compared to what it used to be. So this year is a difficult one to analyze, really. But the fact that executions have dwindled so drastically, I think, reflects the more general long-term trend.
Delphine Lorteau, the executive director of the Cornell Center on the Death Penalty Worldwide. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Bring Back Our Girls, a hashtag originating in Nigeria that gained notoriety 6 years ago. You'll recall that the militant group Boko Haram kidnapped more than 200 students from a school in northeastern Nigeria. Now, sadly, there's a new campaign, Bring Back Our Boys. This after hundreds of boys were kidnapped from a secondary school this weekend in northwestern Nigeria. Journalist and author Adobe Trisha Wobani has reported extensively on Boko Haram's kidnappings, and she joins us from Nigeria's capital, Abuja. Adobe, what do we know about what happened at Government Science Secondary School in the northwestern Katsina State on Friday night?
A group of men stormed the school at night and carted away a number of boys and asking for a ransom.
The whole scenario sounds very brazen. Dozens of kidnappers with AK-47s driving up to the school on motorbikes.
Well, that part of Nigeria, northwestern Nigeria, has been terrorized in the past several months by men doing similar things to villages, hotels, and now schools. So this sort of incident, it's grabbing the world's attention now because it's a school and boys, and it's horrifically similar to the Chibok incident. But then that part of Nigeria, over the past several months, has had similar incidents where men in AK-47 storm different venues and cut away people, steal, maim, murder, kill, plunder, that sort of thing. So that has been happening a lot in northwestern Nigeria over the past several months.
So some of the boys, as you mentioned, apparently were not going to let themselves be abducted. What are some of the stories you've heard where these boys attempted to flee? Is there one that stands out for you?
I was listening to the story of one of the boys today who said he crawled for several miles through the forest before he got back home. So that may explain the disparity in the numbers. The government is saying not as many as 300 are missing. And then the parents are saying, well, we haven't seen so number of people. And so that's really what it is. Just people describing how they managed to flee and nobody knows exactly how many. Still crawling about in the forest.
Right. I mean, a number of the boys managed to flee into the forest, into the woods and hide out. I read another story about a boy who just flagged down a motorbike and got away. But Adobe, why kidnap children? Are they pawns to be used in a ransom? I mean, what's the point?
Well, in northwestern Nigeria, as I said, over the past several months, different kinds of people have been kidnapped. They've kidnapped politicians. They've kidnapped wealthy people, poor people, people driving along the road and asking for ransoms. It's been standard. Almost every week, we hear of a top government official who's been kidnapped, or his family members, or his children, wives, people coming back from weddings, people on their way to funerals, and ransoms, heavy ransoms being paid for them before they return to their families.
So the government in Nigeria often, as you say, blames the kidnapping on bandits, which is a kind of a generic term for thugs. But with the Islamic militant group Boko Haram taking responsibility, do we know that they, in fact, did stage this attack? I mean, this is not, as you point out, their usual area of operation.
Yes. A number of people are skeptical that it is indeed Boko Haram, and I'm one of those people who are skeptical. They've not been known to operate in northwestern Nigeria.
And then these bandits have been operating, as I said, similarly over the past several months without Boko Haram taking responsibility. And this kidnapping happened on Friday night. Boko Haram is taking responsibility today, this morning or afternoon, when obviously they can see that the international media is interested. So it looks like they're trying to take advantage of the incident. And then from what the government had said, there were already negotiations with the kidnappers. Nobody said they were Boko Haram. I would imagine that if it were Boko Haram, they would let us know sooner than now. I doubt that Boko Haram has anything to do with it. But I mean, we don't know for sure.
So these abductions took place in Katsina State. It's the home state of Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari. Buhari made a pledge to bring security to northern Nigeria. What are Nigerians saying about what he needs to do?
Well, first of all, it happened while he was visiting his home state. And just a few days after he returned, this attack happened right in his backyard. So that's why Nigerians are critical. So obviously Nigerians are saying we need more security, especially because this is not the first of the attacks. Many people in that part of the country, I mean, there are certain major roads nobody goes on anymore because people are terrified of being kidnapped in that area. So people are calling on the president to do more. And then there were also calls for him to sack his service chiefs. It's been out of control, to be honest. And the government doesn't seem to be able to put a stop to it.
You alluded to this earlier, Adobe. The kidnappers are thought to be in negotiations with government officials. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that's the case? And what could that yield?
A spokesperson for the governor of that state said that the kidnappers had contacted some of the parents for ransom. And we're also speaking with government officials. So that's the thing. The concern now is because that is the president's state, because it happened while he was there, the military and all the security forces will try to do all in their power to make sure those boys are released so that the embarrassment factor is reduced. And then the military also said at some point that they've surrounded the bandits, you know, and that they're definitely going to get the bandits, but that the concern they have is about the safety of the boys, being able to bring the boys back safely in the process of attacking the bandits. So it looks like, I mean, if I were to believe everything the military is saying, the government sources, they have the bandits in a tight corner, but are reluctant to really go for them because they're concerned about the safety of the boys. So we don't know how it's going to end, but I suspect that the Nigerian government, to reduce the embarrassment on the president, this happening right in his home state while he's on holiday there, will do anything within their power to make sure those boys are released. And it's not beyond them to pay a ransom. We saw they did it for the Chibok girls, and they could very well do it this time. But nobody knows for sure how this will end.
Journalist and author Adobe Trisha Wobani speaking with us from Nigeria's capital, Abuja. Thanks very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you, Marco.
The forest-like smell of pine needles is in the air, and though you won't get that aroma from an artificial Christmas tree, they do have a certain je ne sais quoi. If you disagree, let me share a story with you about one artificial tree that just might win you over. It belongs to Kay Ashton in Sheffield, England, and it is 100 years old. Her grandmother purchased it back in 1920. It could be the oldest artificial tree in all of the United Kingdom. We wanted to know more, so we've got Kay Ashton on the line with us from Sheffield. First of all, Kay, describe your tree. How's it looking these days after 100 years?
It's looking its age, I'm afraid. It's, well, the best word to describe it is actually, it's underwhelming. It's held together with old sellotape, bits of wire. It did sustain some bomb damage in the Blitz, which incidentally, it actually happened 80 years ago, this very evening, on the 15th of December 1940, is the actual night that it actually was blown across the kitchen into the fire. So it carries war wounds, but it just adds to the, well, the charisma, what little charisma that it does have. But it's looking at its age, but it's still standing, as Elton John would say.
Well, it survived the Blitz, so I understand why it's a little forlorn. Tell us a bit about the history of the tree, Kay. How did it come into your family?
It was bought in 1920 from Woolworths, of all places.
Wow.
We no longer have a Woolworths here in the UK. By my grandmother, so it was really her firstborn son's Christmas tree. Sadly, he died as a result of a works accident in 1940, just before the Blitz. So I think the only reason it survived, because, you know, particularly my mum wasn't a great hoarder, was that it was that standing memory of a late brother.
How tall is it, and how do people react when they see it?
Well, it's about 1.5 foot high. And the thing is, because it was made in the 1920s, there was no regard for health and safety. It's actually got on each every branch, which are like goose feathers, it's got a holder for a candle. Can you imagine lighting that tree? It'd burn the house down. And people usually react by going, saying, well, is that it? Because I don't know what they expect. I think they expect something 6 foot. It's just a very, you know, underwhelming little tree.
As you say, it's showing its age. What makes you want to put it up every year?
For me, really, joking apart, because like I said, we do joke about it. But for me, it's the one constant every Christmas that even I remember from being, I think my earliest memory of it, and I'm 66 now, is being about 3 years old. But of course, when I was three, it looked 6 foot tall. So for me, as I say, it reminds me of a family and people that we've lost.
Kay Ashton is the owner of what is perhaps the UK's oldest artificial Christmas tree dating back to 1920. She's been speaking with us from Sheffield in England. Kay, thank you very much. Have a merry, merry Christmas.
You too. Have a wonderful Christmas.
From pine trees, real or artificial, to oil. Tonight is the sixth night of Hanukkah, Jews across the globe celebrating by lighting candles and eating fried foods. For many American Jews, that means latkes, potato pancakes. Turns out it's a tradition that has unlikely origins. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports from her own kitchen.
This has been life at my house for the past 5 nights.
Mister, can we help make some latkes? Can you help me?
I'm singing something.
What are you singing?
Hanukkah, yeah. Hanukkah, light them all over. Let's have a party.
We'll candle. All dance the horror.
Gather around the table. Give you a treat.
Simple fun to play with and latkes to eat.
I've been eating latkes on Hanukkah for my entire life, and I never gave it much thought until this little guy showed up and started asking,
why?
I mean, I know the basics. The story goes, thousands of years ago, a small band of Jewish rebels called the Maccabees defeated the mighty Greek army, which had occupied the land of Israel. The Maccabees made their way back to Jerusalem to reclaim the temple. Part of that was lighting the menorah with consecrated oil, but there was only enough oil to light the menorah for one night. Then something miraculous happened. That oil lasted for 8 nights, and by then they could make more oil. And that's why Jews eat foods fried in oil on Hanukkah. So that's the rough outline. But then I started thinking, why potato pancakes? I reached out to an expert, Tori Avey. She writes a food blog called The Shiksa in the Kitchen.
The potato pancakes that we know today are actually descendants of an Italian pancake known as cassola, which is a fried pancake made with ricotta cheese.
What? I had to look this up on YouTube.
Sono Bruna Tedeschi e adesso vi farò vedere il dolce la cassola, che è uno dei dolci ebraici più noti.
It looks delicious, cheesy and sweet. Like a blintz crossed with a pancake. But how did cassola become associated with Hanukkah? For this, I consulted the Encyclopedia of Jewish Food by Gil Marks, the Bible, if you will, for this kind of stuff. And he said in the Middle Ages, Jews ate dairy on Hanukkah. Why? Because in the book of Judith, according to one version of the story, the prophet Judith saves the Jews by luring the Assyrian leader Holofernes with wine and salty cheese. When he passes out, she cuts off his head. Now, what does Judith have to do with Hanukkah? Some say Judith is Judah the Maccabee's aunt or sister, which is impossible because the Judith story is set hundreds of years before the Hanukkah story. So what it probably boils down to is Judith sounds a lot like Judah in Hebrew, Yehudit and Yehudah. So the two stories became conflated. Medieval Jews started eating cheese pancakes on Hanukkah and the custom spread. But in Eastern Europe, ricotta wasn't readily available and potatoes were. And most Jews in the U.S. descended from Eastern European Jews. So, to use my best Talmudic voice, that's how you get a potato latke on Hanukkah. Sounds convoluted? Welcome to my people. Okay, time to go back to the guy who set me on this journey. I looked up why we eat latkes on Hanukkah.
Why?
Because the medieval Jews started to eat cheese on Hanukkah because of the story of Judith. And
I liked the latkes.
People. He liked the latkes. That's the true miracle of Hanukkah, because this kid doesn't eat anything. Are we happy?
Yes.
Happy Hanukkah, my lovey.
Happy Hanukkah.
And to you guys out there, happy Hanukkah and Betei Avon. Bon appetit in Hebrew. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.